Okay, last time I kind of broke off more or less in the middle of the lecture. Get this. Our goal in this part of the course is to analyze the Berlin crisis. It's a great crisis, central episode of the Cold War. Begins with the Khrushchev ultimatum, so-called, of November 1958. Climaxes with the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962. A crisis that goes through various stages, dominates international politics for 4 years. A crisis that was quite frightening to a lot of people because it seemed that a risk of a third world war, a general nuclear war, was quite real. Okay? And our goal in analyzing the crisis is not just to kind of rip it out of its historical context, hold it up to the light, and try and understand it as a phenomenon in its own terms with its own internal dynamic, but rather to understand the role that it played in the larger story that we're concerned with here, the story of, you know, what's the Cold War about? What's driving this conflict? What's pushing the two sides into conflict with each other? You know, that's puzzling for the reasons that, you know, I dwelled on earlier in the course. But also because of the role that the crisis played in kind of clearing the air. Remember the whole discussion of the Blaney argument and the role that war plays in international politics? It serves to make clear, you know, what the balance of power really is, what countries really care about, because so much of international politics is based on a failure to have a true meeting of the minds. All right, so we're interested in the crisis from that point of view, how when it ran its course, a more or less stable international order soon came into being. Right? That's what we're going to be analyzing this week. The whole story of the period from 1958 to 1963. Crucial period in the history of the Cold War, crucial period in the history of the nuclear age, the second great period of crisis. You know, first great period of crisis was the one that kind of began in 1950, winter of 1950-51, and now you have the second period of crisis. And to understand what it was about, you naturally have to try and analyze the policies of the major parties here. And so above all, the United States and the Soviet Union, but also the three major European allies of the United States, Great Britain, France, and West Germany, and to a certain extent even the People's Republic of China, which begins to play an important role in great power politics about this time. I should say, I'm sure you all know, that it was during the period of the Eisenhower administration that the relations between the Soviet Union and China deteriorated very dramatically. You know, there's the Sino-Soviet split, the Sino-Soviet schism. By 1960, last full year of the Eisenhower administration, this had broken out into the open. I should just say in passing that that's not an accident, that relations between China and the Soviet Union deteriorated so dramatically during the Eisenhower period. There's this great myth that the Eisenhower administration, very ideological in its approach to world communism, that it believed in the notion of a monolithic Sino-Soviet bloc. A lot of the rhetoric from that period was kind of cut from that cloth. You know, very ideological rhetoric. But always when you study these things, you're struck by the enormous gap between what was said in public And what the real thinking was is revealed in the private documents. Just saying, passing, that it's for that reason that so much of political science theorizing about the role that democratic institutions play in shaping international politics and shaping foreign policy, the assumption that foreign policy is a transparent process in democracies, that what you see is what the real policy is, and so on. That assumption, that's the basis of so much important theorizing in contemporary political science, that assumption is so far at variance with what's revealed by the documents that you scarcely know where to begin. In this particular case, in the case of Eisenhower and Dulles, they understood very well that China was not a puppet of the Soviet Union and that there was no such thing as a monolithic Sino-Soviet bloc. And the Dulles philosophy, as he laid it out to his British and French counterparts at the Bermuda summit meeting in December of 1953, was that there's tension between Russia and China. These are different countries with different interests, and it's a fundamental goal of the West to drive them apart, to accentuate those tensions. Obviously, we profit from it. The worse relations are between Russia and China, and so we have an interest in bringing that about. So how, according to Dulles, do you do it? By having, you know, very clearly differentiated policy, by playing up to the Chinese and so on. Dulles' argument was that it's exactly the opposite policy that you should adopt. You should take a very hard line vis-a-vis the Chinese. And why do you want to take a hard line vis-a-vis the Chinese? Wouldn't that drive them into the arms of the Soviets? Well, in a sense, it would lead them to go to the Soviets and ask for aid. But if you have this rhetoric that presents the communist world as composed of a single monolithic bloc, well, then that means that you're basically making the threat that if push comes to shove and there is a war, a U.S.-China war, then the bombs are not just going to fall on China, they're going to fall on the Soviet Union as well. And that gives the Soviets an incentive either to try and pull the Chinese back, which the Chinese might resent, or leave the Soviets to pull away from the Chinese and make it clear to the rest of the world that they're not allies with these people, which would also lead to increased tension between Russia and China. That's the Dulles philosophy, and part of that philosophy is in your public utterances, your public statements, you have to pretend that you think that there are a single monolithic bloc, because otherwise that strategy wouldn't work. And you have to say, when you look at the whole history of the period, you know, well, wasn't that strategy kind of successful, especially when you note the important role that nuclear issues played in the developing schism between the Soviet Union and China. Okay, but so Sino-Soviet tensions, know, kind of part of the story, as we'll see. So we're interested in the goals of the different parties during the Berlin Crisis, because this is the issue that could conceivably lead to a Third World War. Soviet goals, not to take over Berlin, not to kick the Western powers out of Berlin, not even to solve the problem of stabilizing the East German regime, not interested in sealing the border. The great concern on the part of the Soviets is the prospect of this dramatic buildup of West German power, and especially the acquisition by the Federal Republic of Germany, West Germany, of a nuclear capability. Things were clearly moving in that direction. Number one Soviet concern. But they can't dramatize the fact that that's their real concern. Because here you have the Soviet Union. You know, it's basically a weak country in terms of its military-industrial base. Its economy is not that strong. And about half the size of the U.S. economy, far behind the Americans, and all these areas of technology, which are increasingly important in military affairs. And then we add in not just look not just at American power, but also you add in the resources of Western Europe, which far outclass those of Eastern Europe. You add in the resources of Japan. Essentially, also have to subtract from the Soviet side the resources of China, because China is becoming an increasing problem for them. Not a source of strength, it's a source of weakness for them. Yeah, Soviet Union is so much weaker than its opponents. And how do you hold your own in a political conflict when the objective basis of your power is not that great? The answer there is by feigning toughness, by pretending to be much tougher than you really are. The last thing you want to do is to reveal your vulnerabilities and your anxieties and your concerns and so on. You want to make out that you're 10 feet tall in terms of resolve. And it's clear that the Soviets go this route. There's this remarkable meeting that Khrushchev had in 1959 in the context of the Berlin crisis with the veteran American diplomat Averell Harriman. Harriman came back and he wrote his articles published in Life magazine, which is one of the big mass circulation magazines at that time. My alarming interview with Khrushchev, and Khrushchev's pounding the table, if you dare kind of try and enforce your rights about Berlin, the rockets will fly automatically and so on. It's obvious that Khrushchev had no intention of doing that. The Soviets were still quite weak in comparison with the United States in the nuclear sphere. If a war broke out and the United States struck hard enough and fast enough, the United States, maybe even Western Europe as well, would not sustain really heavy damage from any possible Soviet counterstrike with whatever they had left after the American preemptive attack. And you may say, didn't the Soviets know this? Why couldn't they take measures in terms of increasing the readiness level of their forces so that the Americans wouldn't be able to implement the first strike? And the answer there is anything the Soviets did in terms of preparing their forces to survive an American attack would look to the Americans like the Soviets were getting ready to strike first themselves. And that would therefore increase the likelihood that the Americans would take the plunge and order a first strike. So the Soviets would be held back from there. They're really still suffering from very significant strategic inferiority in the nuclear area during this period. Okay, so that's the it's for that reason that it's fairly clear that Khrushchev didn't want to come close to taking any action that involved a real risk of war. So he opted for this policy of bluff. And I'll say one of the odd things is that the Americans were a little slow to see that this was the case. He'd make these threats, back off from these threats, do it again, back off from these threats. The Americans never said, well, it's the boy who cried wolf, He did this so many times, he's not going to follow through on any of this stuff. There's still, deep concern about the rationality of Soviet leadership and so on. So you have the Soviet, Khrushchev not having a real strategy, not having a real sense for how he wanted to achieve his goals, but basically, just turning up the flame, keeping the pot stirring, pot bubbling, and give it a stir from time to time, and in the hope that something would happen. In the event, it turned out to be right, because in the event, the upshot of the Berlin crisis was that Germany's non-nuclear status was reaffirmed, as we'll see in the course of this week. But it was not a conscious, well-thought-out strategy. It's like Khrushchev is not what you would call a well-trained, subtle statesman. He was semi-illiterate. He's a He knew how to read, but he didn't know how to write. Okay, so that's the Khrushchev policy. Well, what about the Americans? The problem with the Americans was they didn't have a clear understanding, you know, partly because the Soviets were not clear about their concerns, about what the Soviets were aiming at. And instead of trying to think through what the Soviets' goals were and to target their own policy accordingly, the Americans basically said, you know, this is not acceptable. We are not going to pull out of Berlin with our tail between our legs. We have every right to be there. We have the power to maintain ourselves there. We are not going to be treated as though we're, you know, a bunch of cowards after we had made all of these promises. If we did that, our whole position in Germany, in Europe as a whole, the world as a whole, would collapse. And that would result in a dramatic shift in the world balance of power against us. And ultimately our security would be undermined, so we're not going to do it. But it was a low-key strategy under Eisenhower, you know? Firm but not truculent. That was Eisenhower's phrase. What did he mean by that? Why was the United States not truculent? Well, there are various reasons for that, as we saw last time. And it's like part of it had to do with the fact that Eisenhower, as a military man, didn't like the status quo in Berlin. The whole notion of America being committed to maintain its position in this exposed outpost, totally surrounded by communist land power. You know, this is not something that's really pleasant for a military man to contemplate. And especially since everyone knows that America's nuclear age is not going to last forever. It'd be, you know, for the reasons I explained. Direct deterrence is a lot easier than extended deterrence. It's much easier to build a nuclear force such that some of your weapons will survive an enemy attack and go on to cause unacceptable damage to the attacker. Much easier to build a force so that some will survive than to build a force so that you could totally neutralize the capability of your adversary. You know, second strike capabilities, it's called. It's much easier to achieve than a first strike capability. And no matter how much the United States spends on its nuclear forces, the day will come when the Soviets are able to build their forces up to such a level, in absolute terms, that enough will remain after even the most successful American strike that the Soviets would then be able to go on and launch a retaliatory attack that would destroy the United States as a functioning society. Everyone knows that this is coming. It was odd to people at the time that it didn't come earlier. And this was this great puzzle that led to the emergence of the bureaucratic politics paradigm in American political science. It's like, how do you explain it? It's totally irrational that the Soviets would allow themselves to be vulnerable to an American first strike if they didn't absolutely have to, especially since they're pursuing what was, in political terms, a fairly aggressive course of action, Berlin crisis. How do you explain it? And they came up with various answers to explain it, but everyone kind of knew that sooner or later, not too distant future, 3, 4, 5 years down the road, something like that, the Soviets would have a second strike force, and therefore the Americans couldn't contemplate a preemptive strategy, a first strike against the Soviet Union. And in fact, we could date these things fairly accurately. It was only in September of 1963 that President Kennedy was briefed by the group that was responsible for evaluating these things. It was called the Net Evaluation Subcommittee. That the days when the United States could contemplate a first strike were over. Preemptive strategy out of the question. The Soviets would have too much left over, even from the most successful American first strike you can imagine, for us to go that route. But that's September 1963. Here we're still in the Eisenhower period, 1959, 1960. But everyone knows it's coming, and since it's coming, maybe it makes sense to reach a solution with the Soviets while you still have the upper hand in strategic terms. If you just put off everything until the era of nuclear parity dawned, that's to say, to the point where the Soviets developed a second strike force, then it will be too late. Your bargaining advantage would have dissipated. Your trump cards would have disappeared. So now's the time to move toward negotiations. And Eisenhower's interested in that. And then there's a third factor having to do with the attitude of the Allies. Eisenhower doesn't believe in simply laying down the law to the Allies. You see, sometimes American governments do that. Acheson tried to do that in September of 1950. But Eisenhower is different. It's like, the United States is the head of an alliance, but the United States has to treat its allies seriously. We want real allies, not satellites. This is the Eisenhower philosophy. And we want to reach a meeting of the minds with our main European allies. The problem is that they're all over the map in terms of the policies that they're pursuing. The British, during the Berlin crisis, are very reluctant to embrace a strategy that involved the actual use of force in the event that Berlin was cut off and that the Soviets followed through with their threats. The last thing they wanted was a nuclear war to develop over this Berlin business. And so the British Prime Minister, Macmillan, pursued a policy of, practically trying to mediate between the Soviets and the West. He flies off to Moscow in March of 1959, I think it was, tries to kind of reach some sort of understanding with the Russians. This is anathema to the other three allies. The Americans view it as tantamount to appeasement. The Germans are totally outraged. The British, they're not strong enough to really pull this off, and they don't want to kind of step outside the alliance and move to a neutral position. So they don't really push this thing. The Germans, on the other hand, they take this absolutely rigid line. No negotiations, no discussions, no concessions whatsoever. Because the German policy was, maybe we can't change the status quo in Europe, we can't change it through force, but the least we can do is not give it a seal of approval. Right? The least we can do is not give it anything like formal acceptance. And so the German policy is one of kind of non-recognition. No recognition for East Germany, not de facto recognition, not treating this country as anything like a state. Because to do that would mean that we're giving up on our hopes for reunification. So anything that points in that direction, out of the question. That sort of hardline strategy, this served Adenauer's political purposes. He was not a big believer in reunification. And he knew that he had this rival, the German Social Democratic Party, that took reunification more seriously. Reunification could only be achieved through some sort of neutralization of Germany. Because the Soviets aren't just going to throw East Germany into the pot to be added to overall German power and overall Western power. If Germany remained in NATO, you're not going to give East Germany over. So if you want to consider reunification at all, you have to give the Soviets something in exchange. What is it? Germany leaving NATO, neutral status for Germany. Okay, for Adenauer, that's what's anathema. No way that you're going to take Germany out of the Western community. The whole essence of his policy is integrating Germany in the West, so Germany becomes a Western country, changes the basic political culture of Germany. Germany takes on the coloration of its allies, the political coloration of its allies. By the way, a policy that was extraordinarily successful. It is just amazing how Germany changed in terms of its political culture during this whole Cold War period. So, all right, But to pursue that policy, what do? The whole idea of reunification was popular. You know, the Social Democrats, you know, could easily say Adenauer is giving up on reunification by privileging the integration of Germany into the West. Right. And so, and they may come to power and win a majority in the parliamentary elections and so on. And so what you had to do was to discredit that policy. How do you discredit that policy? By adopting a policy that on its surface seemed more extreme, right? So Adenauer says, we will not accept even the eastern border of East Germany, what was called the Oder-Neisse line, the border between East Germany and Poland, as final. We will not accept the fact that all these German populations had been driven from their homes in what was now Poland and Czechoslovakia at the end of the war. You know, very hard line sort of policy. The reunified Germany should be totally free to choose its military alliances and so on. Now, it was not a serious policy. And Adenauer, as a matter of fact, said as much to the Soviet ambassador, who complained about this business. It was for domestic electoral purposes, to kind of outflank his Social Democrats from the right by adopting those nationalistic positions. Precisely because Adenauer was afraid that nationalism would have too much appeal in Germany and prevent him from pursuing the policy he wanted to pursue, which is a West Germany integrated into the Western world, but a strong West Germany. Anyway, so the Germans had kind of dug themselves into this hole and had adopted this very rigid line. And the Americans said, Americans want some sort of negotiation. You need to put something on the table. They want more flexibility in terms of demonstration of one's willingness to live with the status quo, including live with the East German regime. Allow the East Germans to kind of stamp documents on these convoys that were going from West Germany to West Berlin, all that kind of thing. And so there's a kind of a showdown between the Americans and the Germans. And one key element in the showdown has to do with how far the Germans are willing to go in the military sphere. Because while they're not willing to make any concessions, they kind of make it clear that they're opposed to the use of military force in the event the Berlin business comes to a head. The whole issue comes up when Dulles already has his cancer. He's, you know, these American men of that generation were very heavy smokers, and Dulles has already been diagnosed with lung cancer, and he's going to die from it later in the year. But his last visit to Europe, January of 1959, he meets with Adenauer on this whole issue of what should the West do if the Berlin business comes to a head? The Soviets sign their treaty with East Germany. They liquidate the rights of the Western powers and so on. Should you use military force or not? How far should you go? All those kinds of things. And Dulles said, well, you know, in the final analysis, we're going to use nuclear weapons. If we're not willing to go that route, you know, basically the entire game is lost. And Adenauer turns to Dulles when Dulles says this, and he says, for God's sake, not for Berlin. No nuclear war for Berlin. But for the Americans, it's like, on the one hand, you're so rigid politically, you're unwilling to make any concessions and negotiations with the other side. On the other hand, you're not willing to use force. Those two things don't add up. Right? You need to be more flexible politically if you want to, have any hope of solving this crisis short of the use of force. And that American pressure has its effect, and the Germans are willing to make certain concessions in certain areas relating to the status of the East German regime. Right? But they are not willing to make concessions in the key area, the fundamental area for Adenauer, which is the area of West German power and the whole question of an acquisition of a nuclear capability by West Germany. Okay? And Eisenhower is unwilling to force them. As a matter of fact, instead of leading the Western powers to rethink the nuclear sharing policy, the Berlin crisis has the opposite effect. It's like, It underscores the importance of military preparedness. And since NATO has a strategy of of relying on nuclear escalation for the defense of Europe. That means that the European allies, if they're to play any role at all in their own defense, have to be armed with nuclear weapons. So this is not time to rethink nuclear sharing, but rather to intensify one's efforts in that direction. All right. The last of the three major NATO allies is France. This is the France of General Charles de Gaulle. And it's important to note that de Gaulle's policy, he basically aligned himself with Eisenhower, yeah? Oh, thanks. Oh. sorry. you'll see what I'm going to say. Okay, so you have the French policy here. I'll turn off that light. And what was de Gaulle's policy? He didn't want a war for Berlin. He felt that maybe in the final analysis, concessions would be necessary. But the crucial thing was that the West not lose West Germany in the process. Maybe ultimately you have to write off West Berlin, but you didn't want to lose West Germany. And if you were too quick, as the British were, to make it clear that that you were not going to go to war for the sake of Berlin, well, then you've lost the game in advance. So you had to play a certain game and feign a greater willingness to use force than you actually felt. And this meant that he was basically aligning himself with Eisenhower. I call this the strategy of the safety net. Right? It's like, maybe Berlin will be lost. Maybe the NATO system as a whole will collapse. Because the Americans might not want to kind of risk nuclear war for the sake of Berlin. In that case, it was crucial that Germany, West Germany, not be lost as well. Alternate arrangements had to be put in place. The Germans had to think not in nationalistic, kind of parochial terms, but rather in terms of a unified Western Europe with common strategic interests, a Western Europe built on a strong Franco-German Entente. And in order to lay the foundation for that alternative to the NATO system, you had to show a certain toughness in these negotiations, certainly at the outset. That's the French policy. And it meant that the Americans were not just imposing their views on the European allies. That the fact that the French were willing to go along with it meant that the American policy on Berlin had a more of a continental flavor. It wasn't just, you know, made in Washington. Okay. Eisenhower is faced with a situation. He doesn't want to just lay down the law to the Europeans. He wants to kind of shepherd all of the European allies along so that they would agree to a common policy. Not the easiest thing in the world. But that implied a kind of a mixture of firmness and flexibility. And flexibility was keeping the door open for negotiations. And so Eisenhower kind of embraced the idea of a summit, and the summit would be prepared by a direct meeting between Eisenhower and Khrushchev. And Khrushchev was invited to the United States and came over in September of 1959. It's a very famous incident where Disneyland had just opened in Orange County, and he wanted to see Disneyland very much. And there were security problems in terms of allowing him to see Disneyland, so he couldn't see Disneyland, and he pouted for a bit. So he comes over, and he meets with Eisenhower at Camp David, which is the presidential retreat in the Catoctin Mountains in Maryland outside of town. And they have some very interesting meetings. To my mind, the most interesting part of these discussions has to do with a comment that Khrushchev made, drawing the parallel between the situation in Germany and the situation in China. See, they're both divided countries, except in a sense, they're not They're not the same because the real China is the People's Republic of China, not the nationalist government on Taiwan. Taiwan is just an island, it's very small. But the real Germany is the Federal Republic of Germany, whereas East Germany is just this little kind of communist policy. If you're going to take a certain line vis-a-vis Germany, it's bound to have implications about China. The basic Soviet line is, let's all accept the status quo of a divided Germany. The West should recognize East Germany. You know, just the Soviets have diplomatic relations with West Germany since 1955. The West should treat East Germany the same way. And it's the West Germany's refusal to do so that, you know, was one of the elements of instability, according to Putin. But if you take that line about West Germany, let's have a two Germanies policy, well then that what that implies is you have to take the same line about China. You have to embrace, both sides should embrace a two Chinas policy. Let's both accept the division of both of these countries. And the interesting thing was, it wasn't Eisenhower who said this, it was Khrushchev who says. Khrushchev tells Eisenhower, he says, well, you know, there's an inconsistency in your policy. You're very much in favor of a, kind of a two Chinas policy, but when it comes to Germany, you refuse to take the same kind of line. In other words, Khrushchev is basically saying, let's make a deal. And Eisenhower at this point, he's too obtuse, I think, to see what Khrushchev was saying, because his response is, well, yeah, it's true, these issues are very complicated. See, the Eisenhower of 1950, 59, 1960 is very different from the Eisenhower of 1953. Eisenhower of 1953, this kind of tough soldier, you know, very much on top of all these issues, you know, Eisenhower in 1959, after strokes and heart attacks and stuff, it's like run out of steam, intellectually. People kind of sense this as a big element in the 1960 election. But Khrushchev doesn't give up on this business. Right? The Berlin crisis is shelved because of the Camp David meeting and so on. Khrushchev says, well, we could suspend the deadline for a while. They schedule a summit, supposed to meet in Paris in May of 1960. But the interesting thing is shortly after Khrushchev meets with Eisenhower at Camp David in September 59, he goes on to Beijing to meet with the communist leaders. And he kind of lays out the same sort of thing, you know, words of the Chinese communists when they were kind of complaining about Khrushchev after the Sino-Soviet split really became very open, very public. They said that at this meeting, Khrushchev tried to sell the Chinese leadership on, quote, the American plot of the two Chinas. Right? So it's clear that Khrushchev understands this parallel between the German and the Chinese thing. The Americans aren't quite up to the point of kind of exploiting. So then what happens in the rest of the Eisenhower? There's no basis for a settlement of the crisis because the Americans, essentially the Americans are unwilling to give the Soviets the one thing that they most want, namely these limitations on German power, especially in the nuclear sphere. Too deeply ingrained in the basic Eisenhower philosophy. And the Soviets, knowing that you can't have a successfully negotiated settlement, and you can't, and you're certainly not willing to go to war, because you're just so much weaker than the West, they're in a box. What are they supposed to do? Here's summit conference that had been scheduled for Paris. The Americans sense that there's not going to be a successful resolution of the crisis at this meeting. Maybe war is inevitable. If war is inevitable, what do we need? Target intelligence. We need to know where the Soviet forces are located. And they had developed this reconnaissance aircraft, the famous U-2 spy plane, that could fly so high over Soviet air defenses, and then could kind of look down with these remarkable new cameras that were developed by this U.S. photographic genius. His name was Edwin Land. You may have heard of Polaroid Land Camera Company. That had such high resolution that you could really look down and see exactly what was going on the ground, even though the planes were flying so high that they couldn't be shot down normally by Soviet air defense forces. And so the Americans are sending over these U-2s to gather this target intelligence precisely because they think a war might be in the cards. Soviet point of view, this is scary. And what the Soviets are able to do is shoot down one of these planes. And they use this fact that the Americans are engaging in espionage of this sort as a reason for breaking up the Paris summit. So outraged, the Soviets are outraged that other countries engage in espionage like they never do it themselves, right? And people are scared at that time in mid and late 1960 that the breakdown, the failure of the Paris summit would mean that the Soviets are going to follow through with their threats because they have reiterated these threats. They're going to sign this so-called peace treaty with East Germany. The crisis is going to come to a head. But it doesn't happen. And it's not like people draw inferences from the fact that it hasn't happened, that Khrushchev is a bluffer, that he doesn't want war. But, people scarcely even notice the fact that the Soviets are doing nothing, that it's a dog that doesn't bark. And the crisis goes into remission for the rest of the Eisenhower period, the rest of the year 1950. So it's waiting to see what happens with the new administration. And this is the new administration of John F. Kennedy that comes to power in Washington in January of 1961. So, and the Soviets do, start heating up the Berlin crisis again, start making threats. Now, Kennedy, his whole approach to these things is radically different from Eisenhower's. A very dramatic change from Kennedy to Eisenhower. You have this whole Eisenhower concept, freestanding Europe, Americans who could pull out, a unified Europe, stand up to the Soviets. The European allies should be armed with nuclear weapons. America shouldn't have to provide for their defense. Kennedy and his associates, this was pie in the sky. These people weren't being realistic. European unification wasn't something that just you'd snap your fingers and it's going to happen overnight. These are ancient countries with very distinct national traditions. They're not going to, abandon their independence, the right to kind of determine their own destiny just because the Americans have been preaching at them to do so. Certainly for the time being, for many, many years to come, you're not going to have a true United States of Europe, a true pooling of sovereignty there. So if you arm the Europeans with nuclear weapons, they'll be ultimately under national control. Is that a problem for the Kennedy people when it comes to Britain? Not really. In fact, no one cares much one way or the other whether the British have nuclear weapons. Same point about the French. Not a problem. But it is a problem for Germany, mainly because of the Soviet concern about what a German nuclear capability would mean in terms of the stability of the post-war system, but also Germany's friends in the West, France, Britain, and smaller countries, Benelux countries, Denmark, so on. They do not like the idea of a German nuclear, nor do the people in the Kennedy. President Kennedy himself, World War III generation, had been a junior officer in the war. No way the Germans are going to get included. Well, if the Germans aren't going to be allowed to defend themselves, who's going to provide for their defense? France? It's hard enough in the United States, a really strong country, to provide for an effective defense of Britain, France, they can't do it. They don't have the resources. There really is no alternative than for the United States to remain present in Europe. and for American power to remain the backbone of a political military structure within which German power is contained. No purely European solution to the problem of the defense of Western Europe. Right? No purely European solution. The Americans have to stay in. We're stuck there. We might not like it. We didn't want it. We tried this alternative. But we're stuck because there is no alternative. We can't allow the Soviets to take over all of Western Europe. On the other hand, we can't really allow the Germans to develop the kind of forces they would need to be able to defend themselves. Only the Americans could provide an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. We're stuck. Right? But as long as we're stuck there, we may as well get the benefits of that. If our own necks are on the chopping block, if our own cities are at risk, basically, because of this commitment to defend Western Europe, we have the right, the moral right, to basically set policy for the West as a whole, to determine the conditions under which we would go to war, to manage the political process, or the Western side of the political process that could lead to war. That's the... And so you have this concept, this Kennedy concept. The Americans are in. The Germans are down. Okay? There's an effective counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. We recognize that the Soviets have major interests. They should recognize our major interests. The two sides should relate to each other as great powers. Now, on a business-like basis, taking full cognizance of each other's power. Okay, and that's the Kennedy philosophy. He thinks he could strike a deal with Khrushchev. He moves rapidly to have a meeting with Khrushchev. The meeting is scheduled for Vienna for June of 1961, just a few months after Kennedy comes to office. And he read the minutes of these talks. They're quite extraordinary. Basically, Kennedy says to Khrushchev, "We understand your interests in Eastern Europe. In other words, we accept Soviet preeminence in Eastern Europe. We accept Eastern Europe as a Soviet sphere of influence." Kennedy clearly thinks in spheres of influence terms. But by the same token, you should understand our interest in Western Europe. And they say, "We understand your concerns about German powers, meaning German nuclear weapons. We will meet those concerns. But in exchange for that, you should recognize that we have very special interests in West Berlin. And you should respect those interests because we are there by right." So it's like a deal. A deal's on the table. Stabilization of the status quo in Europe. It's a stabilization policy. Each side should respect the status quo, the division of Europe into spheres of influence. Each side should respect the status quo in Berlin. Each side should respect the status quo of a non-nuclear West Germany. On that basis, we can live with each other. So you think, deal's on the table. Let me break off there, and then next time we'll continue with the Kennedy policy and then see what happens. I'll try and take it up to the Cuban Missile Crisis next time.